Welcome to Malpractice Podcast.
So, are you ready to get started?
Hello. Yes, I am.
Hello.
This is Malpractice Podcast. That's
yeah,
Jess.
And I'm Jess.
And I'm Sydney.
And we are here.
We're here. We're ready. We're in this. Mm-hmm. Let's get going.
It was Sydney's surprise birthday this weekend.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Surprise.
My husband and Jessica, my husband with Jessica's assistance, surprised me. We took a trip to San Diego. It was magical. I loved it. It was so much fun. Do you have anything to add?
The end. No.
Jess got me a delicious cake and a massage.
Period. Eric did a great job. Shout out to Eric.
And tell me what more anyone wants than a trip with a cake and a massage. Tell me what more.
Never heard of her.
What more could you ask for? Me? Nothing.
It was so fun. And then Sydney's parents came too. Who
my parents came.
I'm obsessed with. So it was also good for me.
Same. I'm also obsessed with my parents. So wins all around.
Everyone's winning.
San Diego's lovely. If you've never been there, highly recommend it.
However, the gondola ride at the zoo. Done. Messed up.
So we basically got some giant alcoholic, what do you call them?
Snow cones.
I was going to say smoothies. It's not a smoothie. It's a snow cone.
Ew, an alcoholic smoothie.
That sounds disgusting. We got giant alcoholic snow cones. We were having a bop, having a good old time. Got on the gondola ride at the San Diego Zoo and got trapped.
Trapped.
Like maybe, what? How high off the ground do you think we were? 40 feet?
I don't even want to know. It was so scary.
We were about, I'm going to say 40 feet off the ground, maybe higher, for...
It was higher.
It was between like 30 and 40 minutes.
Yeah. No, it sucked.
And they kept making this announcement that was like, it's not an emergency. Don't worry. And I was like, the more you say that, the more I feel like
the
death
more
is
worried
imminent.
I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, like, it's not an emergency for you, guy, making the announcement. Like, you're not in a gondola hovering above the lion enclosure.
It's correct. You're not.
So shut
and
your mouth.
And I am. And I hate it. Yeah. My mom, on the other hand, was like, throw up a hot dog for us to the people on the ground.
Yeah, she was having a good time.
Yeah, she was fine.
She was taking a snooze.
Yeah. We, on the other hand, not having fun. Very scared. I'm also terrified of heights.
And then we were done with the zoo. Yeah. Yeah, we were done after that. We said, bye-bye.
Getting trapped on a gondola at the zoo, number one, was something I never thought I would have to talk about. And number two,
never wanted to
experience that.
No. I'm, like, so scared of the zoo, y'all. I can't. I'm like, let's not get close to the enclosures.
Some of those enclosures, it feels like maybe they haven't done their due diligence on, because I'm like, I know a jaguar can jump that far.
Period. Or the tiger. Y'all already know how I feel about tiger attacks.
Correct.
You cannot underestimate a tiger. You cannot be more prepared for a tiger. Mm-mm. If you feel like you're the most prepared, you're wrong.
You're wrong.
There's something that tiger can type you an email. That tiger will kill you. I'm so scared of tigers.
As you should be. Tigers are terrifying.
They're so terrifying.
They're killing machines. Have you seen their claws?
Killing machines.
And I'm like, I don't really want to be close to a tiger.
Nope.
I don't get a feeling of like, wow, look how cool that tiger is. I get a feeling of like, that thing will eat me and my whole family.
Yes. Yes. Sydney's mom and I have the same zoo-going attitude, which is like, stroll on by, quick walk, get my steps in. Everybody else is like reading the information. We're like, peace out, Girl Scout. I want a pretzel. We had like 55 pretzels at the zoo experience.
We did eat 55 pretzels.
But your mom and I were talking about, because people stop to look at birds, which is something I just will not do. I don't like birds, and I think they're the most boring animal. I'm so sorry. And then we were in the quote-unquote shark exhibit, which had like one shark in it, and it was like a leopard shark because it had leopard spots and nobody can come up with an original name.
Correct.
And she was like, do you like this? I was like, this is number two on the list of things I don't care about. The birds and then this big aquarium of fish.
This is also partially my fault because when we go to the zoo, the only thing I want to know from everybody I'm there with is like, what are your top three exhibits? If the answer is not like elephant and giraffe as your top two, you're just wrong.
No, I love elephants. I could have stayed looking at those elephants all day.
The elephants are always for me the highlight.
They're so cute. And he was scratching his back. Remember?
They're geniuses. They're so smart.
They're a matriarchal society.
They can do cool things like draw paintings. Elephants have funerals for their dead. Like, they're so smart.
Yeah.
They're the best.
They're so cute.
What else? We ate all the time.
I'm still full.
A massive amount. Yeah, I'm still, like, recovering. What else? It was so fun. It was just a really good trip.
It was super fun.
We hope you all have fun holiday plans. We're chilling for the holidays. Speaking of holidays, on a slightly grimmer note, this is a sad transition, and I'm sorry. We want to send our like thoughts and vibes and prayers to the people who passed away in Wisconsin after, you know, a car drove into a parade full of people. The sixth victim passed away today, and you know, honestly, I have no words besides this is a senseless act of really sad and disgusting violence.
Yeah.
And we're so sorry for the people who have lost a loved one, and our thoughts are with you.
Yeah, and I hope that you get justice. That's all that we can say because 100%. It's disgusting and it makes zero sense.
Yeah, I was reading some of the obituaries and the family's post today, and one of the people who passed away was a member of the Dancing Grannies squad.
No.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Not the Dancing Grannies.
I can't imagine losing someone who is so full of life and so, you know, bringing so much joy to the people of that community. It's a devastating loss. So we just wanted to kind of off the top say that and say that we're,
acknowledge that.
Say that our thoughts are with you.
Absolutely.
You want to get into the meat of this episode now after that super depressing topic?
I don't know how to transition now. I'm just like...
There's no transition,
sad.
And I don't even know why we're pretending like we try to have transitions at this point.
Okay, I'm going to let Sydney do that little introduction because she, y'all, loves the person we interviewed. Granted, he's really cool. I will say, like, he's got to be the top three of the coolest people we've talked to.
Yeah.
But Sydney was like, I love. And I was like, okay, girl, he's cool. But this was like a Sydney episode. So
yeah,
I want to give you like the privilege of introducing Brucington, which is not his real name.
It's not his real name. Thank you for the privilege. Honestly, this man is...
He's so cool.
So interesting and so cool. I think you guys are really going to love this episode. I have never met... a special agent I didn't like, first of all.
I don't think I've ever met one.
A part of my never-ending quest is figuring out how to combine my existing job skills with hunting serial killers. No, whatever.
Sydney wants to be on Criminal Minds is the situation.
I 100% do. I wish if they called me and were like, Aaron Hotchner needs you, I'd be like, I know that's a fictional character and I am on a plane right now.
And I am on the way.
Literally to come. So our guest today is Agent Bruce Sackman, who spent his life investigating medical serial killers. Three words that you don't want to see in the same sentence.
Coolest man ever.
So cool. We're going to talk to him today about angel of death style murderers who use their positions as healthcare professionals, and they often get away with crimes for extended periods of time and end up with insanely high body counts because of the nature of their crimes. Because of their field being doctors, nurses, and medical practitioners, this particular type of murderer is often very difficult to track. But that's exactly what our guest today does. We're going to hear all about exactly how retired Special Agent Bruce Sackman uses his experience and skills to hunt the doctors and nurses who kill veterans. Bruce Sackman is the retired special agent in charge of the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Office of Inspector General. I know that's a mouthful. And he's also the co-author of a fantastic new book called Behind the Murder Curtain. We'll link that in our show notes.
Which we both purchased.
We both purchased and started reading. It's fantastic. It's so interesting. I think you guys are really going to like this episode today. Bruce Sackman, despite having the name Bruce Sackman and being forced to go into being a special agent. Have you ever heard a more special agent name than Bruce Sackman?
No. And he literally is, he's from Long Island. Like, he is exactly what 100%. You want today when you hear that
literally.
Description. Like, you will not be disappointed.
When I saw his face, I was like, this is Bruce Sackman. 100%.
Oh, yeah. You about to be a good guy.
He's a great time. You guys know, like Jess said, I love medical crime. I love true crime. I was so excited to talk to someone who dedicated their lives to doing such a cool and necessary job. So,
yeah.
Without further delay,
take it away, Bruce.
Here's Bruce. Yeah.
My name is Bruce Sackman, and I served as the special agent in charge of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Inspector General, Criminal Investigation Division for the Northeast. And what that huge title actually means is that I was responsible for all major criminal investigations involving the VA hospital system from West Virginia to Maine. And actually, not even the hospitals, but the outpatient clinics and the regional offices. And I had a wide variety of cases to pick and choose from. And it's not just unique to the VA hospital system. They were actually true in all hospitals. I mean, we had drug diversion cases, theft cases. We had bribery of government officials because contractors were trying to bribe their way into the VA system.
Oh, wow.
You know, we had benefit fraud. So we had an entire smorgasbord, if you will, of cases to pick and choose from. Until all of a sudden, one day I got a phone call that really changed my life. I got a phone call from the chief of psychiatry at the Northport Long Island VA Medical Center. And she said, you know, Bruce, you're not going to believe this, but we have a physician working here, and there's a news story that he spent time in prison for poisoning his coworkers. And first I had to look at the calendar to see if it's April 1st, if this was like, all right. And then I looked at the phone and I said, are you serious? Because I didn't think that you could get a job with the federal government treating our nation's heroes, having spent time in prison for poisoning your coworkers.
Right.
Boy, I was wrong. And that's when I learned about Dr. Michael Swango. And a little bit about Dr. Michael Swango. When Michael Swango was in medical school, his fellow students referred to him as 00 Swango, licensed to kill.
Oh my God.
Wow. We've never heard that before.
Yeah, it seemed like every time he would visit patients on occasion, it would expire unexpectedly. Nobody could actually prove that he had anything to do with it, but the students were so concerned that they actually went to the dean and they put a board together, and by one vote, Swango was allowed to stay in medical school and continue his education. He just had to spend an extra 6 months after the class graduated just to make sure that he was up to snuff.
Wow.
So he winds up getting an internship at Ohio State University Medical Center. There was a young student, a gymnast. Her name was Cynthia McGee, and Cynthia McGee got in a car accident with another student. And she was actually improving until she got a visit from Dr. Swango. And then she expired unexpectedly. But Michael Swango didn't get charged with that murder. You know, the student who hit her with his car he got charged with faking a homicide.
Wow.
He didn't kill Cynthia McGee, though. It was actually Dr. Swango who killed Cynthia McGee. So all of a sudden now at Ohio State University, they're saying, you know, patient seems to be dying unexpectedly here, but we can't prove it. We can't prove that it's Swango, but we don't want him to work here anymore. So he left and he went to his first love, I guess, which was actually being an emergency medical technician, because he loved the excitement of pulling up to an accident and, you know, doing his first aid and showing off to the staff all his skills, because after all, he was a physician, they weren't.
Right.
And he's doing a pretty good job. And then one day, he decides to bring in some donuts for his coworkers. And that night, his coworkers go home and they all get sick. And Swango's calling him up and he's saying, tell me the symptoms. Tell me what happened to you. Tell me everything. Because he was reliving the excitement the first time when he actually put the poison on the donuts. And the second time is hearing how they suffered from that.
Wow.
So these EMTs were not stupid.
Wow.
Expected something. And about 2 weeks later, Swango comes in with some iced tea.
Sure.
And he says, hi, guys. I have some iced tea.
Right.
Would you like some iced tea? And they go, oh, yeah, sure. We'll have it later. All right. And they have it tested and it's loaded with arsenic.
Oh, my God.
So they call the police, and the police do an excellent, excellent investigation. They arrest him. They go to his home. They find arsenic. They find books on arsenic. And the next thing you know, he gets sentenced to, I think it's 3 years in jail for poisoning his coworkers. Now, I didn't think in the United States of America, you could spend 3 years in jail for poisoning your coworkers and come out and be a physician again. Wrong.
Wow.
Because that's exactly what happened. And Michael Swango, being a sociopath, could be very charming and very, very convincing.
Sure.
So he comes out and he changes his name and he starts forging all kinds of documentation showing that he spent time only 6 months in jail because he was an ex-Marine, tough guy, and he got a barroom brawl and he got sentenced to 6 months in jail. But the governor of the state restored his civil rights. And he has a piece of paper saying my civil rights are restored. And next thing you know, he's a doctor again. So he's working in on the West Coast at a VA hospital. And he actually meets a VA nurse and they fall in love. And everything's going beautiful until the story comes out that he had spent time in prison for poisoning his coworkers.
Wow.
And then everything goes to everything goes bad, all right? And she breaks up with him. She goes back to Virginia to mom and dad. And she says, you know, I've been getting all these headaches and I'm so depressed over what happened. I really love this Michael Swango. I'm just so depressed. I get so many headaches. And one day she takes a revolver. She goes to the park and she blows her brains out right there in the park. Well, you can't blame Swango for that, can you? Well, actually, you can. Because even though the family had the body cremated, they kept the lock of her hair. We tested her hair, and it was loaded with arsenic.
Oh, wow.
He was actually poisoning his own fiance. Well, to make a long story short, eventually he winds up in my neighborhood, and that when I get that phone call.
Wow.
He winds up at the Northport VA Medical Center. Now, how did he wind up at the Northport VA Medical Center? Well, he went for a residency at Stony Brook Medical Center, which has a teaching arrangement with the Northport VA Medical Center. And he went there, and guess what discipline he went there for? He went there for a residency in psychiatry.
Yeah.
So that means he had to go in front of a board of trained psychiatrists and convince them all that he should be in the program. And he was so convincing with all those bullshit stories of his that they bought it. And the next thing you know, he's working at the VA. So I hop in the car with one of my agents and we go talk to him and I meet Swango.
Wow.
And he looks like a movie star. I mean, he's a handsome, charming ex-Marine doctor. If my daughter brought him home, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah.
Look who she's bringing home, a physician, ex-Marine physician. Oh, my God, right? And he starts giving me this, you know, story with the barroom brawl thing. And I'm like, that's so interesting. You know, I said, thank you very much. And I'm in his dorm room, and I asked him for permission to search his room. And that's when his attitude changed dramatically.
Yeah.
Then he wasn't Mr. Nice Guy anymore.
Oh.
Okay. And he asked us to leave. And I really had to leave. And I called the U.S. attorney and asked for a search warrant. But she said, you know, Bruce, you don't have any evidence that he committed any crime at the North Port VA Medical Center. So I can't give you a search warrant. So the next thing you know, Michael Swango is gone. He leaves the United States. He goes to Zimbabwe, Africa. And when he's in Zimbabwe, Africa, he kills women and children and pregnant women. And he had to return to the United States to have his passport renewed. And that's when we arrested him, but not for murder, because we didn't have any evidence that he murdered anybody. But we arrested him for every federal agent's favorite crime, which is lying to the government. So he lied to me, he lied to the government, okay?
Yeah.
And he got 3 years in jail for that. And that gave us a three-year window to try to determine if he had murdered anyone at the Northport VA Medical Center. Now, even though I had talked about this smorgasbord of cases that I had never done a murder case in my I never did. So I talked to my boss in Washington, D.C., and he says, Bruce, don't worry. You know, we're going to hook you up with somebody who really knows this business. And they hooked me up with Dr. Michael Bodden. Now, you may have seen him on TV. He used to have a show, Autopsy.
Yeah.
Every time, like a famous, you know, suspicious death, he's usually there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, Bruce, this is what we're going to do. He says, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to pull every medical record of every patient who was at the Northport VA when Michael Swango was there, because he used to, you know, rotate and walk around and go to all the wards and everything, okay? And then what we're going to do is we're going to assemble a team. And this team is going to consist of himself as a forensic pathologist, a toxicologist, you know, to check for the poisons.
Sure.
A physician, a VA physician from Texas actually came, to who was an expert in chart review, because he can make that determination if the patient's death, just looking at the chart, seemed to have been unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was kind of explained to me that natural death is like you shut off a fan and the blades gradually slow down.
Yeah.
But these people were like a light bulb.
Oh, wow.
They were bright 1 minute and dark the next. Mm-hmm. In fact, many times the families would go visit dad at the VA hospital and they'd say, you know, he seems to be doing great. We could go on vacation and we'll come back and we'll see him, only to get that call from Michael Swango telling them that dad had expired. You see, that was his second shot at enjoying the murder.
Yeah.
The first one was actually murdering the patient.
Yeah.
The second one was calling the families and telling the families about how dad suffered for that last 20 minutes or so of his life. I mean, that is really...
It's sick,
very,
yeah.
Very sick and very painful. Okay. And also on this team, we had forensic nurses. And now at that time, it was a relatively new profession, all right? And forensic nurses were phenomenal, okay, because not only do they understand the science and the nursing, but they also understand the forensics.
Yeah.
And they were able to sort of, I would say, dumb down to me what the doctors were saying when they were talking about all the science. Hey, look, you know what? Most cops don't become cops because we're good in chemistry and biology, okay? So we really kind of depend on other people to help us. And the forensic nurses were phenomenal, not only in this case, but I try to use them in every case that I've ever had. I mean, they were just sensational. All right, so we narrow it down to about five cases that the team believes that these patients' deaths could not be explained.
Okay.
And when you look at the death certificates, they all say the same thing. myocardial infarction, you know, some heart-related ailment, sort of a catch-all for everybody, all right? In fact, there's a famous story about death certificates. What happened in Staten Island, one of the five boroughs of Manhattan? In Staten Island, people who look at these statistics were saying, my God, everybody in Staten Island seems to be dying from myocardial infarction. What the hell's going on here? Must be that pollution from New Jersey that's coming over and killing everybody, right? Well, it wasn't the pollution at all. It was actually fraud because the death certificates were fraudulent. They were actually filled out by the funeral homes who were in a rush to bury people. And they would forge the doctor's name and they would put down some heart-related ailment for everyone.
Oh, okay? Wow. Yeah, you can't do that.
Really? Yeah, no. Okay. So the death certificates, they have this catch-all, but most lay people are under the misimpression that the treating physician is actually the one that has signed this death certificate, and he's confident that that's the cause of death. And you and I both know that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Okay. So we narrowed it down to these five, and the next thing we have to do is go visit the families. Now, could you imagine getting a visit like this in Ohio? My name is Special Agent Sackman. I'm with the VA Office of Inspector General, and we have reason to believe that your father's death is of a suspicious nature.
Yeah.
Can we have your permission to go to the cemetery and dig up his body?
Yeah.
Imagine getting a visit like that.
The
families were great. The family was sensational in every one of my cases, okay? Sometimes the family actually wanted to be there at the cemetery.
Oh, really?
They wanted to see the exhumation. So I found myself for the first time ever at a cemetery, and the backhoe comes, you know, and it's digging up the gravesite and pulling the coffin up from the ground. And then Michael Bodden jumps into the gravesite and he's taking soil samples. I go, what is that all about? He says, well, we have to see if there's arsenic in the soil, because if there's arsenic in the soil and we find arsenic in the body, they're going to say, well, it just creeped in from the soil.
Oh,
yeah. Like something that the defense would use to say that.
That is adequate.
Okay.
Wow. Y'all are super smart.
No kidding.
I would have been like, why are you doing
that? Yeah, that's what I said. I said, boy, he really gets into his work, this guy. He's, you know? Then I find myself at the morgue. Never been in a morgue before, never saw an autopsy before. You know, it's a bit of a cultural experience. You know, and the next thing you know, they're doing the Y incision, they're opening up the body, and Michael Bonin takes out the heart and shows it to me. He says, you see, Bruce? There's nothing wrong with his heart. This guy didn't die from heart disease.
Oh,
all right?
Yeah.
So they started taking all tissue samples and blood samples, and they made a determination that these patients were injected with one or two substances, and there was no medical reason for them to have it. The first was succinylcholine. All right? You know, they call it sucks in the hospital, and if they want to put it down you, you know, it it actually paralyzes you so they could put a tube down you. So he used that.
Right.
And the other drug was adrenaline, which, you know, epinephrine, which is adrenaline, which will speed up the
heart. Yep.
So we found traces of that, and there was no need to be traces like it. Well, next thing you know, and now this took a long time to do. Next thing you know, Michael Swangle's about to get out of jail for lying to me. And he thinks he's going to hop on the plane and go right back to Zimbabwe. Well, yeah, right back to somewhere in Africa. Not so fast. Because by the time that he was in jail, the United States had actually entered into an extradition treaty with the government of Zimbabwe. So we said to Swango, we said, hey, Doc, you know, if we go to trial, and even if we lose, we're just going to put you on the plane and drop you off on the tarmac in Zimbabwe, where they have an arrest warrant for you.
Yeah.
For allegedly murdering women and children and pregnant women in Zimbabwe. Blonde hair, blue eyed guy, there's an arrest warrant for you in Zimbabwe for killing a number of their people. Well, it didn't take him long to think that he should plead guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I bet it didn't.
And he did plead guilty. And at his sentencing, and the sentencings are always very emotional and dramatic because the family is. The family has an opportunity to speak. And the family gets up and says, you know, Dad, he made it through the war only to be killed at a VA hospital. And it's very moving. Except Swango, you know, he didn't really pay any attention. And then the judge asked Swango to articulate exactly what he did. And Swango got up and he said, I used a paralytic to murder people. And he explained to the judge right there. So he pled guilty in, really in order to avoid the death penalty, because in the federal government, there is a death penalty. And he got sentenced to 3 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. And the judge said something I had never heard before or since. The judge said, you know, Dr. Swango, he says, I'm sentencing you to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. But if Congress should change the law and now have parole in the federal system, your parole is denied in advance.
Wow. So
Don't even think about it.
And then later, Swango also pled guilty to killing Cynthia McGee.
Right.
So that after that case, all of a sudden I became the agency expert because I'm the only one in the agency. And now I'm the agency expert and I get called for every time there's an allegation like this. But I'll tell you something very positive to come out as a result of the Swango case. And that's the world of medical credentialing improved dramatically.
Yeah.
Because nobody wanted to have a Swango on their staff again. Okay.
Yeah.
So from medical credentialing being almost an afterthought in some places, now, you know, there are teams of people in hospitals that verify all the credentials of the staff, of the nurses and the doctors. And, you know, every year or so, they have to update everything. And all of that came about as a result of Swango.
Wow.
So that was a real positive to come out of that. Now, if you want to know how many people Swango killed, you know, the thing is, the big difference between medical serial killers and your traditional, we'll call them traditional serial killers, is that traditional serial killers, I guess they kill about 7 or 8 people. And sometimes, you know, these are people who, you know, maybe went jogging on a lonely path, or prostitutes or something like that. But my medical serial killers, the average, I would say, kills somewhere between 30 and 50 patients.
Wow.
Jeez.
You know, and everybody goes to a hospital. Everybody goes to a doctor. You know, Swango, we estimate, killed about 60 people. See, medical serial killers kill so many people that even when they want to answer the questions, they can't remember themselves how many people they killed.
Yeah.
That's how many people they kill. And they get away with it in large part because no one wants to believe that a medical professional is intentionally taking lives. And I can understand this. Look, first of all, the last hospital that I worked in, particularly in New York, I mean, they performed miracles every day. They were saving lives and performing miracles. I mean, the staff was incredible. And to believe that somebody so dedicated to saving lives is actually had inserted him or herself with the idea of taking lives is difficult, not only for the patients, but particularly for their coworkers and staff to believe. And that's one of the reasons why they get away with it so long. But there are other reasons as well. But if you think about it for a minute, if you're so inclined to commit a series of murders, what profession and what location might you choose? Well, let's think about this for a minute. All right. Well, first of all, you want to choose a profession that has the power of life and death over an individual.
Yep.
Well, professions do we know have that. Okay. Some serial killers are masqueraded as police officers, you know, but we know other professions that have that, all right? You want to work in a community of people that have taken an oath to protect and serve.
Yeah.
Either it be the Hippocratic Oath. I know some nurses take this Florence Nightingale Oath. It's all essentially the same thing, you know, to do no harm to the patients. And they do no harm. I mean, it's an incredible group of hardworking, dedicated people. You also want to find a job where the victim and the family trust you implicitly.
Yeah.
Listen to that nurse, sweetheart. Listen to that doctor, sweetheart. They only have your best interest in mind. And of course, they do have your best interest in mind. 99.99999% of the time. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you also want to work in a location where the strong and the assertive all of a sudden become the meek and mild. I'm in the hospital. I don't care. You could be the largest weightlifter construction worker ever, and you're not feeling well, and you just kind of lay back and don't ask any questions. And sometimes huge construction workers are scared of that little nurse who's coming over with that needle.
Yeah. Right?
So they don't ask any questions and they just sit there and kind of take it. Boy, that would be great, right? Okay. Now, how about working in a field where there's a real shortage of people?
Yeah.
In some parts, even in the United States, it's very difficult to find doctors and nurses. I mean, look, we have to go all the way to the Philippines.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've heard of nurses coming in from Ireland. So, you know what? If we didn't do such a great job, particularly during the pandemic, of a background investigation, well, forgive me. We couldn't find anybody.
Yeah.
We couldn't find any staff here. Okay.
Right.
So
I heard I think this might have been from your book about Kermit, Texas. There was a case in Kermit, Texas.
Because I know you're Texas ladies and
we are.
I don't want to get you angry, but I got to talk to you about Kermit, Texas, okay? All right, so let's talk about Kermit, Texas.
It seems like Texas has a lot... Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. Does Texas have a lot more medical serial killers than other places?
It does for some reason. I don't know why.
I don't know why either.
All right, let's talk about Kermit, Texas, okay? Kermit, you know what? It takes a lot of courage to be a whistleblower in a hospital.
Yeah.
A lot of courage. Okay.
Yeah.
I will tell you that stories, and I think this is also in the book, about nurses who blew the whistle on Kristen Gilbert in Massachusetts. And after she was convicted and they returned to work, they were ostracized by their fellow workers. You know, we work so hard to save lives here. And because of you and your whistleblower activity, every time people drive by the hospital, they say, that's where the serial killer worked. Nobody talks about how we save lives. Nobody talks about all the wonderful work we did. Why did you have to call the police? Why did you have to start this investigation? Look how you harmed the hospital. And this is, so whistleblowers have a very, very tough time. Now, keeping that in-
without any mention of Kristen Gilbert, who she killed, it was higher than 30, right?
It was about 30, you know, because we're not even sure ourselves, but we estimate about 30 veterans.
I hope you're going to talk about that one too.
I'm going to talk about that too.
Okay.
Kermit, Texas. So Kermit, Texas, there are two ladies who are the entire compliance department of the hospital. All right. And they suspect this doctor of harming patients. All right. So they go to the management and the management says, do you know how hard it is to find doctors in Kermit, Texas? We have to go all the way. You know the story, right?
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you a question, nurse. Because you're bringing these allegations forward, is your background so perfect? I mean, if we drug tested you now, are we going to... Is your license up to snuff? Or, you know, have you completed everything you're supposed to complete? Because once you make these allegations, in some way, you're like kind of under investigation as well.
Yeah.
So you should.
It's like shooting the messenger.
Right. You sure you still want to do this? So these nurses say, holy cow, what the hell are we going to do now? We went to management and they told us to go back to our room and shut up. So one nurse says, I have an idea. Let's send an anonymous letter to the Texas Medical Board about this doctor, which they do. And the doctor gets wind of it, and boy, is he pissed.
Yeah.
So he calls up the local sheriff, who happened to be one of his patients, and he says, Sheriff, his name was Robert Roberts, Sheriff Roberts, I think these two women are intentionally trying to harm my reputation. I want you to help me. And the sheriff says, don't worry, Doc, I'm on the case. And he gets a search warrant, and he goes into their hospital computer, and he discovers that they're the ones who authored the anonymous letter to the state, and actually has them arrested and charged with misuse of official information, which is a felony.
Wow.
Okay. So these women get arrested. They get taken out. They lose their job. And they go to trial. And the jury's out for about 20 minutes. And they come back and they say, are you kidding me? These nurses deserve a medal for what they did, not to be criminally prosecuted.
Good.
And they won the case and they got money back and all that. But what kind of message does that send out
right
to every other nurse or doctor who's thinking about bringing these allegations forward? Okay. Do you want to wind up like these two nurses in Kermit, Texas?
Yeah.
I don't think so. So Kristen Gilbert in Massachusetts. Now, you know what? My vision of a serial killer had always been like a crazy Charles Manson type. Crazy head with a swastika on his
forehead. Yeah.
Just a total whack job, right?
Yeah.
Well, here comes a typical soccer mom. You know, oh, hi, Bruce. How you doing? Yeah, I'm taking my kids to the game. I'll talk to you when I come back. And she actually used epinephrine, by the way, to kill people. And why did she kill people? You know, we really need to talk about the motivation. And her case is a perfect example of what used to be known. I have a new name now, but I like the old name, which was Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Yes.
Okay. Also known as fictitious disorder. But Munchausen syndrome by proxy is a cooler name.
Yeah.
So I heard you say. So what is Munchausen syndrome by proxy? Well, sometimes you hear stories about a mother that will intentionally harm a child, bring that child into hospital to show the staff what a caring mother she is, you know, to get all this attention and all this sympathy.
Yeah.
Well, in the cases of nurses, and this is true not only with Kristen Gill, but this is true all over the world. And I can tell you about some glaring cases of this, particularly one recently in Germany. She would crave the excitement of a code.
Right.
And you know what a code is? Somebody goes in a cardiac arrest, the bells and whistles are going off and they're running you.
All hands on deck, yeah.
Right? It's very exciting. And she used to love that excitement. So she would intentionally put people into a code and then show off in front of the staff how her skills were in trying to save the patient, even though she coded the patient to begin with. All right?
Wow.
And interesting, because at the VA, the people who had to respond to the code, not only the doctors and the nurses, but with a VA police officer who happened to be her boyfriend.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, actually,
the drama.
There was actually like grab ass going on during this code. And at one point, she straddles the patient and her dress goes up and her garter belt is exposed. I mean, right. So it was even for her, even like a sexual experience.
Ew.
As well.
Wow.
And when you look at the evaluation of many of these medical serial killer nurses, you will see they like average nurses, except when it comes to a code. That's when they get an outstanding rating, the best rate.
Yeah.
They are super at codes. Curiously, they get more codes than anybody else.
Right.
All right. But when you look at their evaluation, and they all read the same. There was a nurse in Germany who recently admitted to killing over 100 patients.
Yeah.
My God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he went from hospital to hospital killing patients. And the first hospital never said anything to the second hospital and never said anything to the third hospital. And there's a famous nurse in New Jersey, Nurse Cullen. Nurse Cullen started out in Pennsylvania and he went through about 7 or 8 hospitals in New Jersey until he finally got caught. And the first hospital suspected something, but they never said anything to the second hospital. They never said anything to the third hospital. So in Germany, and I work with the German police on this, and by the way, they're very thorough, as you can imagine. They are very thorough. Okay. They had to exhume bodies in three different countries.
Wow.
We actually suspect that he killed more like 300 patients.
Oh, my God.
We were only convinced the prosecutor they killed 100 patients in three different countries. And he pled guilty. But something unique has happened in Germany. For the first time, I believe, anywhere in the world, the managers who suspected something but just passed him on and didn't say anything to the other hospitals, they got charged with aiding and abetting the murders.
Good, yeah.
Now, whether they get convicted or not, whether they get jail time or not, I don't know. Yeah. But I'm just very excited.
Yeah.
German authorities actually charged these people. Now, they were charged like 2 years ago, and it's still ongoing.
Wow.
We'll see what happens. I stayed very close with my friends over there on that case. But he loved the excitement of a code.
Yeah.
He just, another prime example of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Loved the excitement of a code. Okay. So Kristen Gilbert now. During the trial of Kristen Gilbert, it came very important to try to determine, what was the cause of death. And we had evidence that the deaths were consistent with epinephrine poisoning, mm-hmm. but we wanted to be able to have the toxicology to support that. So the question was, can you find traces of epinephrine in embalmed tissue? And the lab that we used at first said yes. And they said, Bruce, we have this brand new machine. It's called the High Performance Liquid Chromatography Tandem Mass Spectrometer. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. It worked. You wouldn't understand, Bruce. You couldn't understand. But we take some sample and we run these tests. Great. And then we're about to go to trial and the lab calls up and they said, hey, Bruce, I'm sorry. We made a mistake. We can't really say for a fact that it's epinephrine, but have a nice trial.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we were able to prove through expert testimony that the deaths were consistent with epinephrine, that she used to walk around with an EpiPen, that we found epinephrine in her home. So we had enough other evidence to show.
Thank goodness.
Yes, to show that she had murdered patients. And again, we had to exhume bodies. We had to visit the families. These cases take years, and they are very, very, very expensive to run. The lab fees in the Swango case alone cost the government about $1 million.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
But look, we were the federal government. We had that money. I mean, we write checks for $1 trillion every day, it seems. And money doesn't mean anything anymore. Yeah. But if you're a small police department somewhere, this is going to happen.
Right.
I tell you what's going to happen if you're a small police department. Let's say you as a nurse, you go to the manager and you say, you know what? Every time this nurse Bruce is on duty, the death rate goes up. Bruce takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. Does that mean Bruce is a serial killer? No. Maybe Bruce has the sickest patients. Maybe there's
someone. He's the worst nurse.
Yeah. Doesn't mean he's a serial killer, right?
Right.
So you might get the management to agree to do an internal investigation.
Yeah.
So who's going to do this internal investigation? Well, it's going to be employees of the hospital.
Right.
Right? Not somebody from the outside. Right. It's employees have a vested interest to make sure that the hospital doesn't have the reputation of having a serial killer work there.
Yeah.
To protect the hospital.
Exactly. So what are they going to do? They're going to look in the charts and they're going to ask the question, could the patient have it expired from one or more of his natural disease processes? Now, when I started looking in the medical records of the VA patients, they were like this thick. I didn't know you could be alive and have this much wrong with you. And I'm supposed to prove that they were murdered.
Yeah.
To me, like any one of these things could have been a cause of death. All right. So this team this in-house hospital team. They'll review the medical records. Oh. But as you know, hospitals don't really do autopsies anymore because nobody wants to pay for it. All right. And they feel they don't need it as a teaching tool anymore, which I really think they do. So if they do some, a hospital autopsy is not like a forensic autopsy.
Right.
Okay. Hospital autopsy is more of like a confirmatory autopsy. Could the patient have expired from one or more of his disease processes? Yes. And then they'll issue this big report exonerating the nurse. And then the police will come around, okay? And the police will come around, and they'll hear this from the director of the hospital with one of his attorneys, of course. They'll hear this. Well, thank you very much, officer. We were as concerned as you were about this man. So we appointed a board of our very best physicians and nurses, and they looked into the charts of these patients. We ran all these tests, and we came out with this report that shows that all these patients expired as a direct result of their natural disease processes.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to challenge that, officer, if you're prepared to challenge that, well, you go right ahead. Now, how many police officers are going to say, thank you very much, Mr. Director, take that report and walk out? And that's another reason why medical serial killers get away with so many murders, okay? Yeah. Because they're actually supported by the management, hoping that they're just going to move on to the next hospital and not cause all the bad publicity of having someone.
That's crazy.
So I listened to another podcast interview that you did where you talked about the difference between what you do and what the FBI does is that basically they investigate a crime and then they move on. And your job was to kind of investigate crimes and then do a deep dive into the system and exactly what went wrong and change things to make them better. Do you think that if we started looking at management and holding them responsible like they did or they're trying to do in that case in Germany, do you think that that would motivate people to have a more vested interest in not passing off bad or potentially like bad actors moving on?
Absolutely. You know, every time I make this presentation, I have a PowerPoint and I make these presentations. And my favorite audiences, by the way, are nurses. By far my favorite audiences, because they really understand, they really appreciate it. And inevitably, some doctor and nurse will come up to me at the end of my presentation and say, you know, Bruce, there was this one doctor.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there was this one nurse. And we always kind of suspected something. We always felt so uncomfortable with him or her.
Wow.
But they just kind of moved on and we were so happy. But in hindsight, we should have looked. We should have checked. God knows what could have happened. And inevitably, and I've given this presentation all over the world, inevitably somebody will come up and tell me that story. So I am hoping and I am praying that there's some conviction. I don't care whether they go to jail or not, but some conviction of the managers who allowed this to happen, because that is going to be a wake-up call.
Yeah.
Because right now there is none. So all these managers throughout the VA and throughout the United and throughout the world, basically, who have allowed these people just to move on to the next hospital, most of them have never even lost their jobs.
Right.
You know, I mean, on occasion, some of them like were forced to retire or something. But nothing really bad happened to them. So where's the motivation?
Where's the
incentive to do something? It, you know what? It takes a lot of courage. Look, you know, a lot of hospital managers, look, their job, they're concerned about the bottom line. I mean, they're concerned about keeping the hospital open. They're concerned about the reputation of the hospital. But you have to put that aside when something like this surfaces, and you really have to do your due diligence because we're talking about people's lives here.
Yeah.
You know, people's lives all over the world. And look, I mean, it's not just in the U.S. or in Germany or even in Texas where the latest serial killer, you see this New York Times.
I read about this because on the Behind the Murder Curtain website, there's a tab for the recent medical serial killers, and I was reading about this. Please tell us.
Yes, this is the most recent one. Texas nurses found guilty of killing four patients by injecting them with air.
Yep.
He had been trusted with the care when they were at most vulnerable, but prosecutors say that William Davis secretly preyed upon recovering heart surgery patients at a Texas hospital where he worked as a nurse by injecting air into their arteries. And why did he do that? Well, in a conversation that was recorded with his wife, he said he wanted them to stay in the ICU longer so that he could get overtime money.
Oh, my God. You know,
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he said. But financial motivation on rare occasion does occur. Let me just dig up this one.
Oh no,
Texas story. Okay,
we're ashamed. It's fine.
I'm gonna pick on Texas. You ladies are gonna hate. All right.
Oh no.
2016 article in the New York Daily News. Homicidal hospice CEO in Texas ordered nurses to execute patients by overdosing medication in crude cost-saving plan. Familiar with this case?
No,
that's crazy. Okay.
So this is the way. This is the way it works. That's not so crazy. Look at it this way.
It's a little crazy.
You know what? You have a hospice, and how do you get reimbursed for hospice? Well, you get reimbursed for a certain amount of time. If you take patients in too early, not only will your reimbursement start, you might actually be fined for taking patients too early. So if you're the director of this home and you say, you see this guy Bruce over here, if he's still with us for two more days, not only are we not going to get reimbursed for his care, but we may be actually penalized and have to pay a penalty because we took him too early. So you know what? Let's make sure Bruce doesn't live past that time so we don't lose any money and you don't lose your job and we don't have to close up. And that's what happened. That's what happened in that particular. And believe me, that's not the only.
That's terrible.
That is not the only. You know, that is not the only one at all. And, you know, in Texas, you had Nurse Janine Jones, the baby killer.
Yep.
You familiar with her?
I do know that one.
You know, so yeah, Texas has had their share, I mean, but.
Just come relocate here and figure it all out and stop everyone from being trash.
You're our only hope, honestly.
And you know what? Sometimes we're not successful in prosecuting these people.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a nurse in Italy who not only did she kill patients, but she took a selfie of herself with the patient.
Yep.
Okay. And she used potassium, but she was acquitted because patients did not die immediately after she gave them potassium. They died like 5 or 6 days later, so it couldn't be proven that potassium was actually the cause of death, and she got away. And the one that sticks in my craw, because I'm far from Mr. Perfect, is the case of Richard Williams. It's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Richard Williams is the only alleged serial killer in my portfolio that still keeps me up at night. Richard Williams allegedly killed about 60 veterans at the Harry S. Truman Medical Center in Columbus, Missouri. And he used succinylcholine. And it's very interesting because this is a case, again, code junkie. Again, the management supported him completely. You know, the management, they came out with this brilliant idea. They said, you know what? We have an idea. Let's assign another nurse to work with Nurse Williams,
mm-hmm.
and see if he's actually doing anything. So when the second nurse was with Nurse Williams, he was fine.
Right.
But when the second nurse had to, you know, take a day off, take a little vacation or something, guess what happened? The death rate went up.
Yeah.
So the family of one of the victims actually sued the hospital And the judge agreed that, in her opinion, she thought that Nurse Williams had actually murdered these patients.
Yeah.
But there's a different burden of proof, as you know, in a civil case than there is in a criminal case. In the civil case, the burden of proof is just a preponderance of evidence. So it's only 51% of the evidence. So my wonderful forensic nurses had reviewed the cases after the FBI and the IG really failed to come out with, and they did an excellent job, but they just couldn't determine the cause of death. And it was my forensic nurses who actually made the determination, in their opinion, that it was succinylcholine. So again, we went to the lab, and the lab said, "Bruce, I have this wonderful machine, you know, it's called the high performance, you know, the thing." Tested, and it came out, and he says, "Yeah, succinylcholine." So Richard Williams gets indicted for 13 counts of murder. And then I get that phone call from the lab. I see on my phone, the lab's calling. I didn't want to pick up the phone. I was actually afraid to pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And they say, "Look, Bruce, I'm sorry. We can't really say it's succinylcholine, but have a nice try." And unlike Swango and Kristen Gilbert, the VA at this location is not the exclusive territory of the United States. It's actually something called proprietorial jurisdiction, which means the state has the jurisdiction in these cases. And the state prosecutor refused to continue the case without the toxicology. So Richard Williams, I mean, he left the VA and then he went to a nursing home. And you know, it's funny because when he went to the nursing home, you know what happened to the death rate?
Oh, no.
Yeah, it went up. And then he left the nursing home and he's not in medical practice anymore. So, you know, he's my alleged serial killer.
Yeah.
Do I think he murdered these people? I absolutely do. But until the science improves, I can't really prove it. So I have to give him the title of alleged serial killer. And I'm hoping maybe one day things will change and maybe he'll have a come to Jesus moment and talk about it.
Yeah,
but in my opinion, you know, he did murder these veterans.
Yeah,
and it's a terrible, terrible story. Really, a terrible story.
When you start investigating, how long do you typically spend on a case? Would you say
years? You know, look, you have to remember that, and there are ongoing cases right now. I mean, there was an ongoing. The last VA case was in West Virginia, and a nurse killed 13 patients. There are ongoing cases now in the United States that I'm aware of, and they've all been ongoing for years because it's a tremendous time-consuming and, as I point, expensive process, all right? I mean, there are many, many witnesses to be interviewed. There are many medical records to review. There are bodies to be exhumed. There's toxic. You know how long toxicology takes to come back on something of this nature where you're not even sure of what you're looking for.
Right.
So it takes years, years. I don't think you could do one of these cases in less than maybe 2 years. Swango, seven years. Kristen Gilbert must have taken at least 3 years. I have to go back and even take a look. Williams was ongoing for maybe 10 years on it.
Wow.
In Germany, that case was at least 3 years long.
Yeah.
They take years and they're very expensive. So when you talk about the time, you talk about the science, you talk about the money involved and the willingness of police to just kind of accept the view of the hospital management, you could see why medical serial killers have much higher murder rates than your traditional serial killers, because unfortunately, it's easy to get away with. You know, there was a famous medical serial killer named Donald Harvey, the Donald of medical serial killers. he has this very famous thing. I'm going to actually read it to you now, okay? This is a quote. He says, "Well, people controlled me for 18 years, and then I controlled my own destiny. I controlled other people's lives, whether they lived or died. I had the power to control. After I didn't get caught for the first 15, I thought it was my right.
Oh my gosh.
I appointed myself judge, prosecutor, and jury, so I played God. You know, if you kill 15 people and the co-workers don't even give you a second look,
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you probably are like, hey, no one stopped me.
Who knows what you'd start thinking, you know?
Do you think that's why they do it? Like, I know you mentioned Munchausen by proxy is like one of the reasons that people do it, but do you think the other is just control and power?
Yeah, you're getting away with it.
Yes, I think that was Swango. I think Swango just had a fascination with death and the ability to control life and death, as Donald Harvey did. So I think that's a real motivation for some. Like I say, one size doesn't fit all, you know, when it comes to the motivations. But that is definitely one of the motivations for people, you know. You know, Janine Jones, we mentioned Janine Jones, the baby killer. You know, I actually have something that she said. Janine Jones said, and this is so true, she says, what happens to the patient does not matter to the caretaker. What matters is what the incident does for them. All right. So they don't care at all about the patient. They care about the thrill and the excitement they get from either they're controlling their lives or doing that Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And on rare occasion, it just so happens to be a financial reason. In fact, just came out the other day about a nurse's aide who killed a number of patients and stole their goods. And I think he was in Texas as well.
Oh my gosh, of course he was. Of course he was.
We have a higher tolerance for crazy than other states, I think. Maybe that's...
That might be it.
But, you know, the important thing here is, in my little mission here, is education.
Yeah.
To educate people just to be aware. And it's very, it's rare, but it does happen. Is it as rare as we think it is? I don't know, because it's so easy for people to get away with this for year after year after year. And to show you how easy it is, the number one world's champion serial killer is Dr. Harold Shipman in England. Dr. Harold Shipman killed about 300 of his patients, and he actually made house calls. Okay, he went from one house to the next house to the next house. And he used diamorphine to kill his patients. And the way he got caught, he actually changed the will of one of his patients and made himself the beneficiary. And that didn't go over so well with the family, so he got caught. All right. Do you know that he is the one and only physician to ever be successfully criminally prosecuted for murdering his patients in the history of England?
Wow.
Going back to the Norman Conquest, okay? So that goes to show you how difficult it is to successfully investigate and prosecute these people. How much of this I always get, how much of this is going on? How much of this is going on in nursing homes? How much this is going on? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I try to track these things as best as I can. I often get called, you know, from people around the world. But by the time I get called, it's kind of well known.
It's bad.
You know?
Yeah.
So I really don't know the extent of it. And in the book, you know, I have the red flags. And in the book, I have the red flags. And this is just an awareness. Just to give people an awareness to look and say, you know what? Maybe we should pursue this a little bit further.
Yeah.
Maybe we just shouldn't like move this person on to another hospital. Maybe we should do some internal investigation, or maybe we should get some outside.
Yeah, completely agree.
And hopefully we're wrong. Hopefully there are some legitimate reasons for this. All right.
Right.
But the failure to act, I think is really terrible.
What inspired you to write Behind the Curtain, The Murder Curtain? What was your inspiration there?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was the president of the Society of Professional Investigators here in New York.
Of course you were.
And
don't take anyone from Texas. They're not on par.
And I got introduced one day as somebody who has this expertise in investigating medical serial killers. And there were two authors in the audience who said, wow, that sounds like our next book. And they were so fascinated by this. And anytime I've lectured on this all over the world, people always say, have you written a book? do you have a book on it? And I never did, because I knew how, unless I self-published, which I had no desire to do, I just didn't want to do it. So I had a lot of help, you know, and the gentleman who did most of the writing, he's since passed. His name is Jerry Schmetterer. He was an editor for the New York Post and the editor for the New York Daily News and an editor for CNN. So he really knew how to write.
Sure.
And and that was very helpful, but I couldn't have done it myself. Hey, I couldn't have done any of these investigations myself. You know what? I don't care if you're the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes. And not do these cases.
Yeah.
It takes a team. And I've said it 100 times, God bless these forensic nurses. Without them, and I don't want to insult all my other experts, but without them, I'm not even sure we would have made these cases.
Yeah.
That's how important their contribution was. And, you know, I actually got awarded one year by the Association of Forensic Nurses for promoting this. Because, look, forensic nurses seem to spend almost all their time with sexual assault, which I understand is very, very important.
Yeah.
But I always, don't limit yourself. Don't limit yourself just to that. You know, you have such invaluable skills to help law enforcement with other investigations that every time I go to a conference of law enforcement people, and I went to the International Homicide Investigators Association this summer in Washington, D.C., and I say, utilize these forensic nurses. They are an incredible, incredible resource. And luckily, we had a group of them at the VA, and they were phenomenal. Just
that's awesome.
How do you, so you've talked about several different cases, but what is it that ultimately gets these people caught? Is it normally whistleblowers in most of the cases, or is it?
Yeah, you know what? I would have never known about these cases if it wasn't for the courageous nurses and doctors that came forward. And also, it's the numbers. You know, I used to see this in the fraud cases.
Yeah.
If you committed a fraud once or twice, chances are you wouldn't get caught. But when you got greedy and kept committing the fraud, that's when we caught.
Yeah.
So the numbers were so outrageous that actually, in a very sad sort of way, helped us as well. Because if it had been one murder or two murders, I'm not so sure anybody would have even identified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but the whistleblowers throughout the world are phenomenal, but they go through a rough time.
Sure.
And I don't want to discourage anyone. I don't want to encourage them, but I'd be less than honest to say that it's tough. The whistleblowers on the Williams case, which were two physicians, they went through hell. I mean, they just went through hell with management and all. And it's in the book, and you can read about it. But these guys, they had a lot of courage.
Yeah.
What was it like for you going back over cases that you had closed in the past while you were writing the book?
You know, that's an interesting question. It never really bothered me to do this kind of work, because I felt at the end of the day, I was really doing the right thing. You know, out of all the cases, to tell you the truth, out of all the cases I've done, the one that kind of bothered me, aside from Williams, which I couldn't solve, but there was a doctor in Albany, Dr. Cornack. And Dr. Cornack and another doctor, they ran the Albany VA research department. And in order to do research, you know, you have to meet the inclusion-exclusion criteria. In other words, you have to have the correct ailment and the correct blood work and the correct this and the correct that. So this doctor said, where the hell am I going to find 10 people that meet the inclusion-exclusion criteria? And he said, I know. I'll find people that are close, and then I'll alter their medical records to show that they actually do meet the inclusion-exclusion criteria when they don't. And that's what he did. And he put people in the study who should have never been put in the study, and they died. And he gave these people such hope. You know, he said, look, if you go in this study, you know, there's really no cure for what you have. But if you go in this study, there's a fair chance we could cure you and you could go to your granddaughter's wedding and all this sort of stuff. So he really worked at defrauding these people into believing that they would actually get better as a result of being in these studies. And of course they didn't, and they expired. And so, you know, when I met this guy, I thought I'd really like want to just put my fingers around his neck and strangle him. But he was like pathetic. Like he was a loser all his life. And this was not like I felt sorry for him, but I had like a completely different feeling for him. I didn't really have a hatred for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I hated what he did. And I'm glad that he pled guilty and was sent to jail, because it was a terrible, terrible thing. Imagine if it was your dad.
Yeah.
Got this, you know? But it just kind of surprised me that I didn't have that total dislike for him like Swango. I mean, Swango would have loved to have seen hang from a tree somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? I just had a different feeling for him. It kind of surprised me. Really kind of.
Is Swango the worst person that you've investigated, in your opinion?
Yeah, I guess if, well, I think so. Yeah, I think so. You know what I particularly hated about Swango was how he would call up the families.
Yeah.
You know, for that second bite of excitement.
Yeah.
That was pretty rare. My other serial killers kind of stayed away from that, you know, but he so enjoyed it.
Yeah.
He wanted to get that second bite of the apple. So I'd have to say, but they're all pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, got some winners to choose from here.
Yeah, some collection. So the book, and here's the book. It's behind the murder curtain.
I just bought it.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, I'd appreciate anybody who buys it if they'd put a little review on either Amazon or Goodreads, something like that. You know, and there's a website with the same name, behindthemurdercurtain.com.
Yeah.
You could email me, and I love to talk to people and chat to people about this. And anything I could do to help, to educate people, to go somewhere with my presentation, I'm always eager to do that, because the more people who know about this, the safer we all are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we'll link all of that in our show notes. So if you're looking for Bruce's book, it'll be linked in our show notes.
Bless your heart.
It's fantastic.
And the website,
I will say,
because it's really good.
I've read several chapters. It is very, very good. It's so interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to spend this time with you.
Before you go, you've been super generous with your time, but we have one last question. We ask all of our guests, how do you take your coffee?
I take my coffee black, with a little bit of sweet and low. Because I'm vegan.
Sweet and low. Okay.
Yeah, I'm vegan. So I don't have any plant-based. You know, everything is plant-based.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any milk. If it has a mama and a popper, I don't eat it.
That's vegan. Amazing. Wow.
That's awesome.
This was so awesome. Yeah. I swear I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly been my pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. We were so starstruck when you
literally
reached out, because we just did the Swango episode. So we were like, oh, my God.
Oh, I'm glad.
This is so cool. So we really do appreciate it. And the work you do is,
it's amazing.
It makes impact, right? It's amazing. We both have connections to veterans, so we really care about that work specifically, too. So we really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and you guys have a great evening.
Thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
Hey, MalPals. Thanks for listening. The sources and links for this episode can be found in our show notes. If you haven't already, go follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Malpractice Podcast. You can also send topic suggestions, questions, or concerns to our email, malpracticepodcast@gmail.com. And just as a reminder, if you like what you're hearing, you should definitely subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. And don't forget, malpractice makes perfect.